Welcome to episode 210 of Sports Geek. On this week's episode, I chat ticketing and sales with Steve DeLay.
Welcome to Sports Geek, the podcast built for sports digital and sports business professionals. And now, here's your host who is celebrating 300,000 downloads, Sean Callanan.
Thanks, DJ Joel. My name is Sean Callanan, and thank you for listening. I did ask DJ Joel to do that intro because we have recently passed 300,000 downloads for the podcast. So a big thank you to you as a listener. If you are listening for the first time, thank you. If you've been listening since way back in episode one, way back in 2013, if you've been listening since then, thank you very much. It's funny. I actually got that intro recorded before Podcast Movement, and then everyone said downloads don't matter. But it is a metric. But one of the best metrics I have for the podcast is people reaching out and connecting. You can do that via email, sean@sportsgeekhq.com, or reach out on socials, Sean Callanan on LinkedIn, and on all platforms, including the Sports Geek Nation Slack. As always, I'd love working with podcast listeners. If you would like to organise a time to chat, simply go to sportsgeekhq.com/work. This podcast was actually teed up by Michael Brinkman. Thank you very much, member of the Sports Geek Nation, who introed me to Steve DeLay from the Ultimate Toolkit. .com. Steve is a long-time sports business executive with a strong focus on sales, selling tickets, selling at every seat in the house. And if you've listened to the podcast before, heard me talking to people who are about selling tickets, it's all about the cheeks and the seats, as I've said before. I really enjoyed this conversation with Steve DeLay from theultimatetoolkit.com. Very happy to welcome Steve DeLay, the author of The Ultimate Toolkit, to the podcast. Welcome to the podcast, Steve.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
It's normally an opening question I do with a lot of my guests. This might be a long answer, but and you having to reach back in your memory, how'd you get your start in sports?
I always laugh. I'm 6'4" tall, and I was the tallest guy on my high school basketball team. It was clearly obvious I wasn't going to go play college basketball or go be an NBA superstar. So my father wisely told me to stop dreaming and go get a degree. And I said, well, if I can't play sports, I want to work in sports. So I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and the first job I had was working for the Cleveland Indians in their old stadium, sweeping up cigarette butts and spilled popcorn along the concourse for $3.35 an hour back then.
Yeah, that's it, the glamour of sports. You speak to a lot of graduates and students in the sports management and wanting to get into sports, and they just think they're just going to jump in and be shaking hands with athletes and sitting in corporate boxes. But everyone has to start somewhere.
Yeah, Theo Epstein messed it all up by becoming general manager of the Red Sox when he was like 27 years old. Everybody thinks that that's easy to do, and they should be the same way now.
So from those humble beginnings with the Cleveland Indians, how did you find your way, I guess, into the sales space in sports?
I got lucky. I worked part-time for a woman named Buffy Philippo in Cleveland, who was an executive recruiter in the sports industry, and she made it clear that sales was the way to succeed in the sports world. And working part-time for her, I got to connect with a lot of top-level executives in the industry, and one of the guys that called into the office was a guy named John Spolstra, who at the time was probably the foremost sports marketing expert in the country. He was president of the Portland Trailblazers for 13 years, sold every single ticket to every single game, and he had just taken on being president of the New Jersey Nets, who at that point, back in the early 90s, were by far and away the worst team in the NBA, hadn't sold a game out in 7 years. And I answered the phone, and John said, if you want a real challenge, come work for me in New Jersey and see what you're made of.
So this is the New Jersey Nets before they got or just around the time they got Kenny Anderson and Derek Coleman and that era.
Yeah, it was Derek Coleman, Kenny Anderson, Benoit Benjamin, Chris Morris, wasn't exactly what you'd consider a high-flying group of people. I think when I started there, we won 15 games, and then 3.5 years later, we'd improved enough to win 21 games. In fact, Sports Illustrated ran a story about the five biggest crybabies in the NBA, and three out of the five were New Jersey Nets.
So in that role, you know, a tough assignment, it's always easier to take on that tough assignment in sports because there's upside. What were some of the things that you implemented and sort of tackled and learned from John, who has been mentioned on the podcast before, Johannes from the Swedish Basketball Association, sort of followed John's books and implemented a lot of his strategies. What were some of the things you did at New Jersey?
Well, since we couldn't focus on winning, because we weren't, it really was all about entertainment, delivering a product that the fans enjoyed. And back then, in the NBA, it was really at the height of their superstardom with Michael Jordan, Larry Bird, Shaquille O'Neal, Magic Johnson. So, quite frankly, we marketed a product the fans wanted. And the fans wanted to see the superstars of the NBA. They were going to play in New Jersey. And we figured if we can get the fans out to our building, even if they might be coming to see Michael Jordan or Magic Johnson, as long as the Nets were reasonably competitive and showed some signs of improvement, we'd slowly turn them into NBA fans and into hopefully New Jersey Nets fans. So if we could pick up the pace and win a few more games while they were coming and having a great time at our games, we figured long term that would be a tremendous boost. And in reality, that idea of entertain the fans and deliver a product that they want and not worry about wins and losses is what's carried me throughout my career. I've been doing this for 26 years now. I think I've been in the playoffs 4 times. I don't even know what it's like. Never won a title. Don't know anything about that. It's actually more fun to market a team that's really not winning a lot and really, you know, kind of challenge yourself on what you got to do to get people to come out to the games.
Yeah, and that would have been really early on because it's really – now it's very much sports as an entertainment product. I think I had someone ask me that on one of the platforms a couple of days ago. You know, is sports an entertainment product? It has to be because, you know, no matter what league you're in, only one of them is going to hold the trophy aloft at the end of the season. So effectively it's a fail mark for everybody else. So it is that it's an entertainment option. That's a key sales message for what you're trying to do.
Absolutely. And especially this day and age, with as expensive as tickets are in the NBA, the NHL, and most major sports, you know, English Premier League, it really has to be entertaining. Because if you're just worried about winning and losing and, you know, you have 3 or 4 bad years in a row, your attendance is going to drop off a cliff. Yep. So ultimately, it's about creating a wonderful fan experience, giving them a reason to come to your games and have fun. And then if your team wins, great. If it doesn't win, we're all marketers. We don't control the player personnel.
So you've had the opportunity to work in multiple leagues. You mentioned the Nets. You also worked at the Kings, LA Kings, and the Tampa Bay Lightning, and also in baseball with the Las Vegas 51s. What's some of the differences and commonalities between the different leagues?
Well, the funny thing was commonalities were every single team I worked for was terrible.
Yep.
Nets were awful. I got to the Kings 3 months after Wayne Gretzky was traded. So you can imagine the challenge of trying to market tickets there.
Yep.
And then I spent a short time with the Tampa Bay Lightning, who were coming off a 12-61 season. And then when I got to the 51s, and really it wasn't just the 51s, it was Mandalay Baseball Properties. We were the largest operator of minor league baseball teams in the country. We owned at 1.7 different teams.
Yep.
And that really is where it drove home the idea of sport is about entertainment. Sport is about smart, intelligent marketing, showcasing that fans can have a great experience at your games and selling them the product they want. Because nobody in their right mind would buy season tickets for 72 AAA or AA baseball games unless they were glutton for punishment. That's really where it became ticket packages, group sales, make sure fans are having a good time, and focus on the things that they wanted.
So from a sales point of view, you haven't just been focused at the pointy end, getting on the call with potential prospects. It's all the setup work prior to that in what are the packages, how is game day entertainment, what's the overall message of what you're trying to do as a franchise. That has to be worked on because otherwise the sales job gets harder and harder.
Yeah, you can have the greatest salespeople in the history of the world, but if your ticket products are products nobody wants to buy, or you don't have a good marketing strategy, then it's not going to make a darn bit of difference what a great salespeople could do. They can shove season tickets down somebody's throat, And eventually someone might buy, but also eventually if that's not the right product, that's going to, you know, that customer is going to go away. And the long-term value of a customer, really making sure you sell them the right product with the right strategy and you're reaching them cost effectively, is a huge asset. Most sales we make these days at our teams, 70% of them come via the internet. Yep. So salespeople themselves are nearly as important as they were 25 years ago when it was call. But email marketing, digital advertising, follow-up phone calls, salespeople reaching out to church group leaders and school group leaders, that's where the real impact is made.
So, yeah, I wanted to sort of, for the people who are listening either in, you know, Asia-Pacific and Australia, New Zealand, or even in Europe, to give us an understanding of the North American ticketing sales process, because the idea of people in ticketing sales teams, inside sales, is something that may be foreign to people outside the US, but it's a, pretty much a very common starting point for a lot of people in sports. What's the sales process and the sales teams look like in the US?
Well, I'm a big believer of setting up your sales team based on prospect, not necessarily product. There's a lot of teams out there that will say, geez, this group of people is going to sell season tickets. This group of people is going to sell groups. This group of people is going to sell mini plans. Mm-hmm. I'm a little different where I would say this group of people is going to go call on the business community. And when they yep. call on the business community, they might sell them season tickets. They might sell them a smaller ticket patch. They might sell them a group outing. Another group of people is going to call on schools, churches, nonprofits, youth sports organizations. Primarily, they're there to sell them groups. They might stumble across somebody who wants to buy season tickets or a ticket package, but that's usually a group sales effort. And then the third group is the inside salesperson you mentioned. They're dealing with Joe fan. They're dealing with a person who just loves coming to the game. And if they're a crazy hardcore fan, that person's buying season tickets. If they're more of a casual fan and wants to go to one or two games a month, they sell them a smaller ticket package. Now, that inside salesperson could still sell group tickets to Joe Fan. Joe Fan may have a child who plays their sport, you know, a soccer player or a hockey player. They may, you know, belong to a school or church and wants to bring a group of people out to a game. So everybody can sell every product, but in order to blanket the market, you really have to set up a sales staff based on the three key different prospects you have: the business community, the group community, and the individual fan community.
Yeah, I mean that's the thing. I do talk to people who haven't been to a game in the US, and yeah, they're always quite surprised, even though they're working in the business, to have people, you know, inside sales is people selling tickets in the stadium during a game, because those prospects have already said, "Hey, I'm coming to a game. How can we upsell them and start that conversation?" But it's something that's, you know, we don't see a lot of it here in Australia, in you know, talking to the people that are already in the stadium, potentially as maybe they are the best prospects to upgrade them to a different type of package.
Yeah, and I always say, and this is any business, not just a sports team, but it's like there's three ways to increase business. Number one is you can raise your prices, which nobody's really excited to do unless you're mm-hmm. winning those every year. Number two, you can get your existing customers to buy a little bit more. If you can get 50% of your customers to come back for one more game, you've had a huge increase in attendance and they've already experienced your product and enjoyed it. So the opportunity and the difficulty to get them to come back once more is not nearly as hard as going out and finding a brand new customer who's never come to a game, never experienced your product. So our big marketing focus is how do you collect the email address of every single person who comes to your game? And that way you can talk one-on-one to them via email. And then email software these days is valuable or effective enough where you can then also keep track of the people who open emails and click on any links you put in that email. Well, then a salesperson can pick up the phone and call the person. And it's more of a friendly call instead of a cold call.
And how much is, I mean, that's to have that focus for your sales team to be able to sell effectively anything in your product mix. How also is it different when you say look at your whole stadium and your whole strategy to get that potential mix right? It's not about, oh, cool, we'll sell it all out with season tickets or groups or single tickets, but how is it to get that mix right? I know once I had Aaron LaValle from AEG, who works with the Kings and the Galaxy, talk to the A-League teams in here, so the Australia's version of the MLS, and they're very membership-focused. And so they were all very proud of what their season ticket numbers were per club. And then when sort of Aaron talked about the LA Galaxy, being in that market and where they were positioned, they had a really low season ticket base, but they did a lot of a lot in group sales every single game, which astounded all of the clubs. And getting that mix right, knowing your market, how do you sort of, I guess, put the plans in place to know what that mix should be?
Well, it's funny because I always tell people, as far as I know, in all of North America, with all the teams that are there, hockey, baseball, football, basketball, at all levels, there's only two that could sell out their arena on season tickets. It's the Toronto Maple Leafs and the Montreal Canadiens, because people in those two markets are just crazy diehard hockey fans.
Yep.
So the Maple Leafs could miss the playoffs for 10 straight years, and they'd still have 20,000 season ticket holders. Even the NFL teams don't sell their games out on season tickets. They still have to work on group sales, smaller ticket packages. So if I was going to pick a percentage, I'd say if I had at least 50% of my building sold on season tickets, I'd feel pretty good about being able to get sold out every game.
Yep.
But even then, if there's smaller numbers, like I know, like when we were in minor league baseball, we typically would have, maybe 20% of our building on season tickets. But because we'd sell 3,000-4,000 group tickets a game, that would make up for all the shortfall. And the great thing about group ticket buyers or smaller package buyers is their show rate is a lot better. The season ticket holder tends to show like 50% of the time. The group buyer is about 95% of the time. So if they show up, they're louder, they cheer more, the atmosphere is better, they drink more beer, they eat more hot dogs. Everything's better for you with that type of buyer.
I was going to ask you about that because no shows is a global issue. It's not defined to one particular sport, but it's a bit foreign to a lot of marketers that you have to then market to and advertise and do your best to actually almost resell, but actually convince the people who've already bought their tickets to come, because it does affect the atmosphere. Is there something that you look at to potentially solve that problem, or is it just a matter of getting that mix right and making sure people are effectively using their tickets?
Yeah, well, I think it's a combination, and you're right. The resale market nowadays has created a huge problem. Like I lived years in Las Vegas, and the Golden Knights sprang upon the Las Vegas community like gangbusters last year.
Yep.
And I had friends of mine, and the tickets weren't cheap. They were pretty pricey. I had friends of mine who were season ticket holders and said, hey, I want good seats. I'll go to 6 or 7 games, and then I can resell the remaining games on the secondary market. 10, 15 years ago, when StubHub and all the other secondary market tools didn't exist, those season ticket holders were saying, geez, I spent all this money, I better go to all these games, or I'm basically throwing this money out the window.
Yep.
And that's why I think we've seen the downfall of season tickets pretty steadily over time. And then as you go, it becomes a case of when somebody, I'm a big believer as a salesperson, is sell the customer the product that makes sense for them. The people who are going to buy season tickets or should buy season tickets, that's the hardcore fan who wants to go to all the games.
Yep.
Or maybe the business buyer who can give it to clients, give it to employees, and actually can use it. Small business or casual fan, let's not jam season tickets down their throat if they can't actually go to the games.
And especially now that there's so many more entertainment options available to fans, the commitment of going to every game, whether it be 40 games of an NBA team, even more in the baseball sense. There's so many more options than there were 20 years ago. So selling them that product doesn't exactly work because they've got other things that they're available to, but then they've got this option now to offload their tickets if need be.
Yeah, we actually train our salespeople to de-emphasize season tickets. It's almost like someone has to lobby us to buy season tickets. I remember when we first launched the Dayton Dragons, who – that was in 2000. They sold every single ticket to every single game for 18 straight years, like 1,450 in a row.
Yep.
I remember when we first launched the team, we had a call. Somebody called up and said, geez, I want to buy season tickets for my family night. Most teams, most salespeople would say, great, awesome, let me have your credit card.
Yep.
Our salespeople were taught to ask a lot of questions, and it turned out it was a family who had a husband and wife with 4 kids, and he wanted to buy 6 season tickets. And we stopped and said, sir, do you realize – we play 14 home games a month on average. That's like a game every other night. That's like a full-time, almost a full-time job.
Yeah.
And he stopped and went, oh, geez, what else can I do? And we ended up selling him like a quarter season plan, which made more sense. He used the tickets, felt better about it. And the value of that customer over those 15 or 18 years was so much stronger and better than if we'd sold him season tickets in the first year And then he disappeared after that because he never used them.
Yeah, you don't want to set yourself up for failing on renewal.
Yeah, and that's why we teach our salespeople, don't sell somebody season tickets unless they can basically justify that they can actually do it.
And how much is the data analysis of like your ticketing data, your CRM helps get better yield for your seats across the stadium? So you're not going just off the conversations and the gut feel of your salesperson, which are very valid, but how has the data analysis piece now helped that sales process to go, well, actually this is the right ticket, or this is the product we should develop for this type of fan that's only attending these games? How much has that helped the sales process?
It's hugely valuable, but there are some situations where teams can get paralyzed by analyzing data too much. I've talked to NBA teams and NHL teams where they've said, hey, we've analyzed all of our data and we have a larger propensity of people coming to our games from a particular zip code or particular area of the city. So we're just going to blanket those households in that zip code with direct mail and marketing and phone calls. And they're doing that without having any idea whether the person they're reaching out to has any interest in their sport.
Yeah.
I'm a much bigger believer in using data as a way to analyze and improve your marketing efforts. So, for example, even down at our teams, some of our minor league teams, as we run Facebook ads, we track every dollar we spend on Facebook and what the return on that dollar is. So I know last year, one of our teams, for every dollar we spent, we got $38 back.
Yeah.
And we were able to analyze subject lines of emails, which ones got higher open rates, analyze body copy of emails, which ones got better click rates, analyze headlines of Facebook ads that got better click rates. That, to me, is the analytics that becomes more valuable. How do you make your marketing better as opposed to how to take really pot shots out there hoping you hit somebody who looks like your existing customer? That, to me, is a bit of a stretch.
Yeah, completely. And how much has, you know, we're a big advocate of digital and using Facebook advertising to sell tickets. Once you get the plumbing in place, it is quite trackable. How much has that, I guess, changed the game from a sales perspective in your part of the world?
That is the only advertising I recommend to my clients to do. In fact, I've done seminars recently where teams have said, well, geez, we'll run radio spots and TV spots and outdoor billboard advertising. And I'll ask them the question of how many tickets did you sell off of all those ads? And they don't know. And they're just afraid not to do it because they don't know what will happen. And I will flip the switch on them and say, let's only market and advertise in means and tools where we can track it. Digital click-throughs, emails, opens and click-throughs and sales there. And it saves the team a crazy amount of money. And quite frankly, if the team has $100,000 to budget for outdoor advertising and billboard advertising, I'll recommend to them that they cut that in half and put it in their put that half of it in their pocket, take the other half and hire two more salespeople who you can get a clear, specific, tangible return from those salespeople.
Yeah. Or having someone that is dedicated in pulling those levers on all of those digital platforms to be able to say, these ads into this market is converting. It's just pretty much then how much you turn the tap on to sell more tickets.
Absolutely. And then if salespeople are properly trained, when they're reaching out and connecting with those people who are engaging with the advertising, their close rate skyrockets. So it's a combination of effective marketing to people who already are interested in your product and well-trained salespeople with a product that the fan wants. And your close rate would be pretty good, 70-80% of everybody you talk to, if you're effective. That's where analytics and tracking information really becomes valuable.
And so where do you see, I guess, the role of, because, you know, part of sales is understanding the pain points, the story of the fan, the why. How do you get where does the demarcation or who does it in writing those ads and putting together that copy and deciding what image to use? Is it partly your sales team, or is it sort of left back to the marketing digital team? How do you get that relationship working? Because if the sales team says run these ads and the message coming out of the content team or the marketing team, depending on who runs it, doesn't match, those ads are going to fall flat. Who do you find that's the best person to be managing that effort?
I think it's a collaborative effort. I can't tell you how many teams I've seen where the marketing department does not talk to the sales department. And if sales are down, the marketing department tells the owner, geez, I don't know what's going on. I ran all the ads like we always have.
Yeah.
Blame the sales team. And the sales team will say, geez, I don't know what's going on. Our marketing's terrible. Nobody's calling us or nobody's noticing our offers. So marketing's sole purpose is to generate revenue. It's not to create a brand. It's not to create an awareness. Branding and awareness is great, but if it doesn't sell anything, company's going to go bankrupt.
Yep.
So they have to work hand in hand.
Yeah, and in his pretty common, I do sometimes joke that I'm a digital divorce counselor working between multiple departments. And yeah, they do need to work hand in hand, whether it is the content team producing great content that builds the audience that then the marketing team can serve ads to, like that connection has to happen. Whereas if the content team is only driving content to the fans that are just going to the stadium and are already there, then it makes it very hard to build out prospect audiences and people who potentially might go to the game.
And Facebook's algorithm is amazing because if you create great content that gets shared by more and more people then see the content because Facebook says, hey, people are interested in this, we'll share it with more people. And the more of those people engage with your content, the easier it is to serve up future ads to get them to buy something. So it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy with digital advertising. The more people see your ads, the more people are going to see your ads, which means more people are going to buy your product.
Yeah. And the other thing that I do like is you know, and I've had arguments with copy guys sort of saying, this is the line, this is the byline that's going to work, or this is the heading, or this is a, and I just pretty much let the internet and the fans decide. I say, look, cool, we'll run them all out. The algorithms will kick in. The people will click on what they click. Let's not worry about who was right or who was wrong. We'll just follow the copy and the ad and the imagery that works. And once you find something that works, you just, you know, double down on it.
Yep. I've sent out 3, 4, 5 times over the same email to the same list. And the open rates, yeah, they might drop a little bit over time, but it continues to produce and continues to be effective. And there's a lot of marketers out there who are concerned about image and visibility. And they'll say, well, geez, we can't send that again. It's like, wait a minute. If people engage with it and people buy stuff off it, let's keep doing it until they stop telling us and they tell us it's no longer interesting for them.
So tell us a little bit about the Ultimate Toolkit.
Well, it's an interesting product. John Spolster and I, when we worked together at Mandalay Baseball Properties, after he had retired and I had left Mandalay, we kept getting calls from people wanting consulting help.
Yep.
And both John and I said, you know what? We don't really feel like flying all over the country anymore. So what if we just took everything we knew, everything we'd created over the last 25 years, New Jersey Nets, Los Angeles Kings, what we did at Mandalay Baseball Properties, and let's write it all down. Let's give teams a complete system of not only strategy on creating ticket products and marketing, but the step-by-step on how to do that marketing. But also we said, geez, if we're telling teams they need to hire a sales staff to call on businesses, we need to give them the tools to train those people to be successful. Likewise, if we're telling them to call on schools and churches, we got to give them the group sales training tools. Same with the inside sales or individual fan training tools. So we took us about a year and a half, and we created what we called the Ultimate Toolkit to sell the last seat in the house. And it's a combination of ticket sales strategy and tactics, training tools for those three elements, marketing pieces, collateral pieces. Really, the idea is teams can make the investment in the Ultimate Toolkit and never need to have John Spolster or Steve DeLay come visit as a consultant. It's cheaper for them to buy the Ultimate Toolkit. It's quicker. It's easier. It's like having Steve and John 60 years of experience at their fingertips anytime they want. We rolled it out 4 years ago. We probably have about 250 teams around the world. There's probably 7 or 8 international teams using it. There's teams at all levels in North America, hockey, baseball, basketball, football, all colleges, all across the board. Really, it's focused on teams that really want a specific plan on how to increase ticket sales.
And so it is pretty much that drop-in professional develop for your sales team, but really roll out that sales strategy and a plan to go about selling tickets.
Exactly. It's like I said, there's the three key components you have is you got to have a sellout strategy. What's it going to take to get more sellouts? And that's what everybody talks about. Everybody has gets excited when they go to a sold out sporting event. Doesn't matter what it is, when it is. If the game's sold out, that's more exciting and enjoyable than going to see a game when it's 50% full. So you got to create ticket products that drive those sellouts. You got to have a marketing strategy that gets those ticket products in the right target customers' hands. And then you got to have a well-trained sales staff to follow up on that marketing strategy to make sure everything executes flawlessly.
And so, like, you know, I come from Melbourne, and I like to sort of say it's, you know, a lot of sports teams here, and I think they do the membership product. So in Australia, they will call season ticket membership to make it a bit more of a identity product than a transactional product. So you become a member. I think the AFL this year with 18 teams across Australia has just this year had 1 million AFL members across the league, which is a phenomenal number considering there's only 25 million people in Australia completely. And they've been very membership focused. Yes, they've developed out mini plans and that kind of thing. The Ultimate Toolkit still can be applied, I guess, in this market, and there's nuances and adjustments that they can make for different pieces.
Well, absolutely. In fact, I think it'd be even more effective because the 12-month membership is really neat. So even if whenever the season is taking place,
yep,
people are selling group tickets to schools and churches and businesses, they could still, because there's so many other events going on through the membership outside of the season, they could still be using those same techniques and tools to sell group tickets to other events that are part of the membership. They could still be using those same techniques and tools to get people to businesses to see and understand that, hey, this isn't just about 6 months worth of going to sporting events. This is about 12 months of an association with the organization. And it starts to spread to those additional target markets. The membership really started when it was all about how to make the hardcore fan interested in the team year round.
Yep.
Now that that's happened, it's that much easier to get the casual fan interested in the team year round, the business community interested in the team year round, and continue to build on what takes place during the season.
Yep. Yeah. I do think something in that, especially in this market, is that there's that chase for that, in this case, the membership number. So a couple of the teams here in Melbourne, Richmond, who won the premiership last year, they've just passed 100,000 members, which is a phenomenal number. But that's, you know, that's a number from someone who might go to attend one game and they're on the list, to someone who might be spending be a high ticket person. But there can be a bit of an issue in just chasing that number for the number's sake and the vanity metrics when you're not, you know, you've got to make sure that you're getting enough value out of every single person you're selling a package to.
Yeah, revenue pays the bills.
Yeah.
So that's what matters. You got to have money coming in to be able to pay the players, pay the cost. But I love the membership model because what you just said is exactly it, is you don't have to be a season ticket holder to be a member.
Yeah.
You just sign up for a membership, and the season ticket part of it could be an additional cost, but it's another revenue tool and another way for the team to communicate with their fans, people they already know are interested in their product, and get them to buy or make additional investments, whether it's tickets, merchandise, online subscriptions for chat rooms, stuff like that.
Yep.
It's the more you know your customer and you're engaged and connected with the customer, the better off you're going to be.
Yeah, and I think the thing that does work really well here in the Australian market, here in the AFL, and definitely, you know, the NRL is caught up in the Sydney market and the northern markets, is, you know, I like to say it is now at guilt level marketing. I'm a Collingwood member. I'm a Club 5, so I pay my membership once every 5 years because I just find that easier and it shows my commitment. But if I meet someone else that says they're a Collingwood fan, the first thing I ask is, are you a member? So they've got their fans being their biggest advocates and effectively guilting their friends to say, well, you're not really a fan unless you've signed up. And it doesn't mean they have to sign up at my level. They can sign up at their own level, but at least they've got to be able to put, you know, it's that identity-based thing to say, yes, I am a member. I have paid up. And then it starts you on that customer escalator that can either move you up or down to find out where you best fit. But I think that's one of the things that's most effective in this market.
Yeah, and the great thing is, like, people who are fans, they want a little bit of inside information. Mm. So just by being a member, you may not be a member that also owns tickets to the games, but you may be a member that just wants inside information that's not really available via the regular news media, via the internet. It, you know, it could be private chats. It could be private events, things like that. And people will pay good money for that part of the equation. And so teams can look at the whole scope for a full 12-month calendar of what a member entails. And I think it's a great model.
Yeah. And I do think, you know, we started Sports Geek in 2009 and the opportunity of all the digital channels can definitely escalate that and accelerate that conversation with fans. Because previously they would be sitting back in their couch, maybe consuming the game occasionally on TV, and now we've got all these digital channels that are engaging with the fan to deepen their ties, to bring them into that inner sanctum, that they start feeling, well, oh, I'm more involved, I'm more invested, I'm following it more closely because of all these channels. It sort of definitely helps the sales process and moving them into a membership or a ticket or some kind of package because they're a bit more emotionally invested via the content that's being shared across multiple platforms.
Absolutely. That's the power of social media. And a lot of the outside of North America teams, whether they're in your part of the world or over in Europe, have figured that model out. I mean, what Manchester United does is nothing short of amazing. The number of members they have and the sponsorship dollars they generate in places like China, and their teams are there in place once a year. But they've managed to connect the dots and do millions in sponsorships just because they have so many members that are interested in their team and the sponsors that are associated with them want to associate with those members.
Yeah, and that's where I guess that non-attendance season ticket holder or membership, especially in a global sense, is a really big opportunity. You know, if you're a fan of the Golden State Warriors in the Philippines, yes, you can show your fandom by all of these modes. But if there was a way for them to say, yes, I want to be a member or a season ticket holder, I want to show my support, those avenues are definitely have opened up in the past, you know, past 5 to 10 years that potentially say, yes, I'm gonna sign up. Now, whether it's starting with an email with Arsenal to become an Arsenal Red member, but then saying, oh, for 50 euro, I can then become this type of member. They're the opportunity. I think the European teams are sort of opening those doors a little bit quicker than the US market at the minute.
Oh, very much so. Like, could you imagine if you're a fan of, say, Kevin Durant and you're like you, your example, you're in the Philippines and once a month you got the ability to sit in and on a private chat with Durant or Steph Curry or some of the other guys at the Golden State Warriors and in some inside information on that, and you got a little peek behind the curtain. There's a lot of revenue to be had around the world for teams to be able to do that.
You spoke a lot about your involvement in minor league baseball with Mandalay. Tell us about Macon Bacon.
Well, I got involved in baseball as an owner a couple years ago. And in the United States, there's affiliated minor league baseball, which is teams that are associated with major league teams. And that's what Mandalay Baseball Property was for years. We got involved, John Spolster and I got involved in what's called summer collegiate baseball. And what that is it's college players who need a place to play during the summer to impress scouts. Okay. So essentially it's the same talent level as single A and double A baseball players, basically the same age. They just happen to be in college, so they can't get paid.
Yep.
But it's the exact same business model as minor league baseball. So about a year and a half ago, we had the opportunity to go to Macon, Georgia and launch a new team in Macon called the Macon Bacon, and had a lot of fun with the launch of the name. We ended up on Sports Center as the new favorite name for John Buchagrass, one of the nighttime Sports Center announcers. We ended up launching this past year in 2018, sold half the season out, 11 out of our 22 games. We're playing about a 3,500 seat stadium, sold merchandise in all 50 states, sold it in 6 or 7 different countries. Huge plus, a huge great launch for the team and, quite frankly, for the city of Macon. It was a neat thing to do for them to put them on a national stage with a sports team that was imminently very successful and got a lot of buzz around the country.
Terrific. And obviously you just rolled out a lot of the processes that you've learned over the years in rolling out Macon Bacon.
Yeah, exactly. We did a lot of smaller ticket packages, group sales. The difference was this time I was the guy writing the checks to pay the people and hounding them to make sure it was successful. I wasn't doing it for somebody else. So as the owner of the team, It was a little bit different position to be in, but it was great success and, quite frankly, a lot of fun, and can't wait till year two comes around.
Terrific. I wanted to finish with the Sports Geek Closing Five. Do you remember the first sports event you ever attended?
That was a Cleveland Indians game when I was about 8 years old. Our Little League team went, or our whole Little League, I grew up in Cleveland, so our whole Little League went. And I still remember putting on my jersey, putting on my uniform, and as part of the deal, we had a parade around the infield, the old Cleveland Stadium. The old Cleveland Stadium was about 80,000 seats.
Yep.
And in this case, there were probably about 5,000 people there because nobody went to Indians games back then. But it was the coolest thing in the world to be on the field in that huge of a stadium to see that experience. That was awesome.
Terrific. And you would have been to a fair few sporting events. Do you have a favorite food memory at a sporting event? Some of the major minor league baseball do some crazy food, I'm sure.
I'm getting a little bit old, so all those things that you see where it's like a burger, three burgers slapped between two donuts, probably not good for my cholesterol, party stage of my life. But when I was a lot younger, quite frankly, it wasn't actually what was inside Cleveland Stadium. It was outside Cleveland Stadium. I used to go to the Indians games with a high school buddy of mine, and there was always a hot dog cart right on the corner before you walked into the stadium. Since we didn't have a whole heck of a lot of money, we'd stop at that cart. You'd get a hot dog slathered with grilled onions, grilled peppers. We'd buy two or three of those, put it in a brown paper bag, stick it underneath our shirt, and go inside the old Cleveland Stadium. Wasn't in the ballpark food, but it was outside the ballpark food. That was absolutely fantastic.
That's the main thing. That is, again, about making the experience, and food's becoming more and more a thing at ballparks to make the experience more memorable. That's what I'm always looking for.
Absolutely.
What's the first app you open in the morning?
I try and avoid as much as possible going to my phone or going to my computer until after I've taken my dog for a walk and I've eaten breakfast. So that way I stay away from technology, and I don't want my day to get sidetracked by immediately getting emails and Facebook posts and tweets and stuff like that that early in the morning. But after I've walked the dog, I've sat down and ate breakfast, I will typically go through the Make and Bacon Facebook page and read the comments, just because I want to see how people are engaging with us and what their thoughts and feedback is. And then after that, I will check the Make and Bacon Twitter feed to see what kind of feedback and comments we've got there. I've got a marketing guy in my staff that does all the legwork, but I still like to know what the fans are saying.
That's true. I mean, because it is, especially the Facebook page, or it'll be the day after a game or something like that. You can really get a pulse, feel a pulse of the fans in that comment thread. There'll be the overly angry, super passionate, sack the coach because we lost kind of fan, which you want to keep on because they're rusted on and they're highly committed. And then you've got the other person that's trying to calm the waters and talk that person away from the ledge style because they're a bit more even-handed. There'll be fans defending. So it's a really good way to sort of see, I guess, what the fans are thinking.
Yeah, it's kind of neat because you're right. Those fans that are on our side are talking the other people off the ledge, and they're playing the role we would play if that fan had picked up the phone and called us.
Yeah.
So because it's a third party and it's not the team responding back, it actually helps us because it feels a little more credible.
Yeah, and that's one of the things we're always trying to develop is that digital cheer squad to reinforce those people that are doing that good job to say, yes, keep doing that. It reduces the stress and load on your digital and your community people that are meant to be responding. But it's also, that's the message we want. They're the kind of fans that we want. We want people to be passionate about it, but to be on, I guess, on your side. And it's far more effective coming from another fan than if the team came over the top and sort of said, don't say that, or we know you're hurting, or it's always a bit of a balancing act.
Exactly. Yeah. Third party validation if it's another fan trying to calm them down.
Who is someone that you suggest that the podcast listeners should follow, and why?
I got to tell you, one of the guys that I like most as a sports marketer in our country, in the United States, is Dan McGalla. He's with a company called Forefront. Dan, he and his company are always at a whole bunch of breakthrough stuff. They're working internationally. They're working nationally, working a whole bunch of different clients. And he doesn't make a lot of commentary on his own, but the stories and things he circulates, I always find interesting. The other guy I follow a lot, he's not quite as active on Twitter as he used to be, is Peter Guber, who is a former owner of Mandalay Baseball Properties. He always has fantastic insights, articles to share, all those types of things that can become very valuable.
Yeah, Dan has been a good mate of mine, has been on the podcast previously, and yeah, I completely agree, and I hope to one day have a sit down and a chat with Peter, being obviously one of the owners of the Warriors. A lot of insight in the storytelling and that from his movie background.
Yeah, absolutely, and you know he's all about storytelling, and I learned quite a bit from him when I was working for him at Mandalay about how to position stories and make that work, and he's continued to do that.
What social media platform is your MVP? And you can answer this personally, what platform you go to, but then also maybe putting on your Make and Bacon hat, what platform is working the best for Make and Bacon?
Right now, it's Facebook. However, I'm concerned about Facebook fading away. I think Instagram is going to take a much bigger, stronger role as a communication tool. I've got a 14 and 16-year-old niece and nephew, and they haven't been on Facebook in 7 or 8 years.
Yep.
So my mother's 80. She's on Facebook pretty regularly. So that's kind of a clear indication which direction that's going. Snapchat is becoming much bigger and more popular. And it's kind of neat because I now live near my nieces and nephews. So I get to see what they do.
Yep.
And that's the next one. The problem is it changes about every 6 months. What's cool. So it's hard to keep track, but right now I'd focus my energy on Instagram, our growth and development, getting more followers on Instagram, and then kind of keep an eye on whatever's going to happen next.
Yeah, it is a pretty common trend, and a lot of people saying that. I think as we discussed earlier, that the ad product that Facebook has is pretty much very much keeping it in the game. But yeah, their issue potentially of their customer demographic moving, and the fact that the younger demographic isn't as engaged in the product. If it's not an issue now, it will be an issue in 5 years if they don't work a way to bring them back into the product and work a way to engage with them. Because if they just walk away from it, then they're left with an older demographic potentially. But I hold faith that the ad product that they can roll out and over the top of Instagram potentially sets them up going forward.
Yeah, and Facebook's got enough resources now; they can just buy whatever's coming next and figure out how to take advantage of it. So I don't think Facebook as a company is going anywhere, but the platform I think they'll continue to add to as they acquire new and bigger, better technologies.
Definitely. Steve, where can people find you on the internet? What's the best way to get in touch with you?
Best way to get in touch with me, our toolkit website is www.theultimatetoolkit.com. If you want to shoot me an email, my email address is really easy. It's stevedelay@theultimatetoolkit.com. Love talking to people all around the country about the industry. As I tell people, I'm not an attorney. Someone's got a question or needs some advice, I don't charge by the 10-minute phone call or the response to an email. So the more people I can help in terms of ticket sales and sponsorship sales, whether it's in North America or anywhere around the world, I'm happy to do that.
Well, thank you very much for your time, Steve, and all the best for the next season of Making Bacon.
You bet. Thank you, Sean. Appreciate it.
New workshops on audience, content, distribution, valuation, and pitch following Sports Geek's Digital to Dollars process. Go to digitaltodollars.com.
Thanks again to Steve DeLay. You can send him a tweet at SteveDeLay2. That's the number 2. Or you can check out theultimatetoolkit.com. And as he said, you can reach out to him, ask him a question. He's very giving of his time, as he was there. So thank you very much, Steve. Some really interesting things on selling out your stadium, product mix, the different types of products, the importance of digital and how that's been able to be a really sophisticated ticketing tool, and also the piece of getting ticketing, marketing, digital all working together. It's a really important point. You need to have those things in sync to effectively sell more tickets, which is really the business a lot of us are in, filling stadiums. Just a quick one on Sports Geek Nation. In the last week, we've kicked off the AMAs, the Ask Me Anything. The first one was with Tim Baker. If you're a part of Sports Geek Nation, you can simply go to the AMA channel and read that. What we'll be doing post every Ask Me Anything session, we will be archiving that because our Slack community is so active. And our Slack community only keeps the last 10,000 messages. We're up to, I think, 36,000 messages that have been posted in the Slack community over the past couple of years. So we'll be archiving the Ask Me Anything. Thank you very much to Tim Baker from Adelaide United. He did a terrific job being the first person to host an AMA. Going forward, as this one publishes, Alistair Hogg, who works at the ICC, out of Dubai. He's going to be currently in an AMA. So if you're part of Sports Geek Nation, you can go there. You can check out the new members area, sportsgeeknation.com/members area, for all the details of the September AMAs. We've got Alistair currently answering questions. Liam Murphy is going to be doing it the week after, and then Andrew Walton the week after. So it's a really, you know, I'm really pleased with the output of it so far and some of the backwards, the banter backwards and forwards, and looking forward to getting some fresh voices and knowledge into the space. So please join Sports Geek Nation. We'd love to have you on board if you are a friend of the pod. We'd love to have you in there. So please go to sportsgeeknation.com to sign up. You can do so and get access to the Slack and check out the AMAs and start connecting with people in digital, in technology, in stadiums. We've got channels for all of those things, a really strong and active esports channel. Really pleased with the activity and really pleased with the AMAs. So if you're not part of Sports Geek Nation, please do so. Sportsgeeknation.com. As always, you can get in touch with me, Sean, at sportsgeekhq.com or at Sean Callanan on the Sports Geek Nation Slack. Until next episode, my name is Sean Callanan and you've been listening to Sports Geek.
Join Sports Geek Nation, access to exclusive Slack and Facebook groups with regular Q&A sessions with Sean Callanan. Go to sportsgeeknation.com to join. Need help with your digital rate card? Not sure how to price your assets? Is there a disconnect between digital and commercial? That is where Sean works best, in digital divorce counselor mode. Book a time for a call with Sean to discuss the Sports Geek process. Go to sportsgeekhq.com/phone call. Go to sportsgeekhq.com for more sports digital marketing resources.